Hey, welcome to another episode of the 343 podcast. This is a live stream that we had on YouTube. We have it weekly, and this one covers the Argentine national team, the final against Spain, the controversy surrounding all that, why it exists, and of course, a partial breakdown of the game itself. Then per usual on these live streams, we field audience questions as they come in. So you don't want to miss those. Lots of gold nuggets there too. I should remind you that we sponsor ourselves. We don't accept any sponsors. We don't want to be compromised in any way, shape, or form. And the way that we do that is we offer coaching education and parent education at 343coaching.com and 343masterclass.com. That latter one, the masterclass.com one, is for parents. We've codified our decades worth of experience here in the American soccer ecosystem. You need to learn those sorts of things to be able to better guide and mentor your kids. And coaches out there, you go to 343coaching.com to acquire the methodology, the pioneering methodology, the remarkable methodology that has worked here in the United States of America at the youth soccer level. Finally, if you're coaching in the 7v7 format, we've adapted it to that as well at 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed this live stream that we held on YouTube. You should head on over to YouTube, by the way, and like and subscribe there also. Here we go.
I want to start today because we've been getting comments galore in the DMs, emails. When is Gary going to do his breakdown of the final? When's he going to do his post-match analysis of Argentina? And I'm curious too, Gary, because we haven't chatted since the final. You know, I wanted to give you a little space. But I want to hear your thoughts on the final, Gary. Your thoughts on the game, post-game, pre-game, everything under the sun.
Cool. So much to discuss. The most important one is Spain was clearly better. Is clearly better, and they are the best team in the world, and they should have won the World Cup. So justice was served. I think it's also important to note that I almost never do any post-game analysis ever in the history of 343. I don't go and write articles on games. I don't go online and do any sort of video breakdown of game at all whatsoever. I think for the most part, it is a silly exercise because if you want to do it properly, you really need to sit down and study and deconstruct everything. And you have to have the competence to sit down and deconstruct everything. And that is a monumental thing, right? To have the competence first and foremost, and then to go ahead and do it. Could I do it? I think I could. It's just not interesting to me. And so for the folks who said, oh, Gary, why aren't you talking now, you know, and doing a post game, like right after Argentina lost? It's so silly because they never do these things. When the World Cup started, Benny, that's the first time ever that I grabbed my phone and I recorded myself for like giving a 2-minute reaction of a World Cup match. I'd never done something like that before. And I did it very sparsely. And insofar as Argentina is concerned, the first time I did it, was after the Egypt game, perhaps. You know, I'd even talk about it during the group phase or the Cabo Verde. I just did a little 2-minute thing for Egypt. And then maybe I did another 2-minute little thing for Argentina. When was it? After England? Yeah. And it had absolutely nothing to do with respect to, wow, Argentina is so amazing. Ha, ha, ha. We're so good. It had zero to do with that. It had more to do with like a teaching moment that occurred that was valuable. And so, no, I don't do this stuff. But as you said, Ben, you framed it properly. People are interested. So cool. We'll talk about the game. And that's my first remark, is that Spain was superior, clearly a just winner. Now we can talk about why the match went down the way it went.
Okay. This is going to be a fun one, man. And by the way, in those videos that you did, you weren't saying that Argentina is so... You literally said like... Us Argentines think that they kind of suck.
Oh, yeah.
The reason the winning is because of heart and because they're all rallied around Messi. You weren't saying like, oh, wow, Argentina is the best team in the tournament.
Not at all. We live in reality, Benny. Like, you know how we're very critical of other countries or other cultures or of other clubs or whatever. We look and we analyze and break that down. We do it to ourselves even harder than we do it to others. So all of Argentina recognized, yeah, we kind of suck, you know, especially relative to 2022. We're actually kind of self-deprecating in many respects. are we happy or were we happy and proud when the team won its games and advanced all the way to the final? Of course. Are there valuable things to extract from those complicated games against Cabo Verde and Egypt and Switzerland and England? Yeah, of course. And so we highlight those positive things as well. But it's a very strange thing that we've been witnessing, this anti-Argentine sentiment that exists out there.
We're going to get more into that. I'm going to throw the audience out there early, man. Let's start them out. S27 says Argentina had too many MLS players on the field.
That's funny. That's funny.
All right. So, Gary, I asked the same question to Brian, and I'm curious to see what your response will be. I have a feeling it'll be the same. I asked him after the game, hey, Brian, what do you think happened before the game? Right, you've seen all this talk about the team coming out of the locker room, and I forget which player, but he was in tears, and everybody's making this whole like stink of something happened before the game. Do you think anything happened before the game, Gary?
I have no idea. I know what you're talking about. I know the little clips where the team's walking out of like the quote unquote locker room or some sort of area, and they're going to go out onto the field, and Messi's basically saying, hey, forget everything, forget what happened or whatever. Just focus on ourselves and just focus on doing well. All I can say is that it's weird. I don't know what happened. If you want me to speculate or do wild conspiracies, we can have fun with that. But I have no clue, Benny. There's always been suspicion in football. There's evidence to the fact that sometimes players have been threatened, you know, going into games, threatened with family, threatened with all kinds of leverage points in order for maybe the Mexican cartel to get their way, you know, or the Colombian cartel to get their way in a particular match. Who knows? I'm not saying that at all is what happened, but it was weird.
I've heard, and again, nobody knows for sure. Unless you're in the locker room, nobody knows. But something that sounds like it could be true is that Lautaro Martinez was like expecting to start or something. I mean, he didn't start. So he told the coach like to go fuck himself, basically. And then there was all this drama. That's one thing that I've heard. But again, nobody could ever know. When I asked Brian, he said nothing happened. That's all nonsense. Mm-hmm. That's all just fucking people spreading their narrative. So I was just curious on if you thought anything did happen, because I mean, the body language did look a little off, but then again, it's a World Cup final, so you don't know, man. You don't know.
And you don't know. Nobody knows anything. You don't know when that was filmed, where it was filmed, you know, how long before the game. Like, nobody knows anything, Benny. I mean, I guess maybe those facts that I just threw out there, maybe somebody does know. But yeah, man, it's something unworthy of our attention.
All right, let's talk about the actual game, Gary. The game itself. What did you notice? What did you recognize in the game?
Well, I will tell you that before the match, I mean, after England, we already knew what the final was. I already knew that Spain is superior. I already knew that France is superior to Argentina also. I even said going into the England match that England was better than Argentina going into the England match. So we already knew that Argentina was fourth or fifth best, maybe, in the tournament, pound for pound. You know, if you play a game against a particular team 10 times, you know, that sort of probability thing. So I already knew we were underdogs to Spain. And, you know, some people messaged me, hey, Gary, what do you think is going to happen in this match? And I said, I didn't know. But once I saw the lineup, then I responded to those messages and I said, okay, at least I know what Scaloni is trying to do here. And that is they are giving Spain possession. They're not even going to try to fight the possession battle. And if we want to, we can inject I could screenshot these text messages and just for verification purposes, that they were going to give Spain the ball and they were going to look to go on the counterattack, maybe squeeze one in on the counterattack or a set piece or something so that Argentina goes up 1-0. And then that's when they would put in, Scaloni would put in Paredes in an attempt to maybe claw back some possession and not give Spain all the ball all the time and try to ride the game out 90 minutes and win 1-0. That's what I thought the plan was. And so when the game started, for me anyway, I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of how I'm expecting things to go. Spain has the ball, Spain has the ball, Spain has the ball, and we're not doing anything. And I don't know, Ben, it was kind of like a sensation of like, man, let's just get to the first water break. And then after that, I was like, man, let's just get to halftime, 0-0. That's fine. I also knew that Spain wasn't going to generate a lot of clear opportunities. Like, they would have the ball, but that doesn't mean that there's danger on goal. I don't know, Ben. So that was my sensation of the first half. Obviously, everybody knows zero shots from Argentina. Obviously, everybody knows that there was no real threat going forward from Argentina. And I don't know, man. After when the second half started, I kind of felt it was going to be more of the same. And Argentina was just going to have to maybe get a set piece or get lucky on a counterattack to squeak out a win. And if not that, then hold on for dear life until penalties.
Let's talk about the post-game reaction, Gary. You've seen it, man. Everybody now, a lot of the same people that I saw celebrating Argentina in 2022 are now villainizing them and saying that Argentina's racist and they play dirty and they use the dark arts and it's rigged for them. Like, where is this whole narrative coming from, man? Because 4 years ago, everybody loved Argentina. Everybody was rooting for Messi. And now all of a sudden, Messi's some type of villain. Where is this coming from?
I think it's two avenues. First off, I want to read off what Lisandro Martinez mentioned, you know, because I think most of all the players kind of didn't respond or didn't give a message to the public for maybe a couple days or a few days. And then they all kind of came out saying, hey, it hurts, you know, we tried, blah, blah, blah. Congratulations, Spain. And with respect to your question, Lisandro Martinez wrote the following phrase, which I thought is quite apt. Let me see if I can bring it up here because I don't want to botch it. He said, the downfall of the great has always been the joy of the mediocre. The downfall of the great has always been the joy of the mediocre. And so I think that is 50% of what's going on, which I think is in large part why human beings like rooting for the underdog many a times, because they don't want the New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl again, right? They want to see them die. They start not liking Bill Belichick, right? Because he's won too much. So now he's a cheater and he's like a scumbag and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems like fundamental human nature for most humans. They want to see the successful people eat shit. And the second component to this is, since that is a truth, all somebody has to do, or a group of people have to do, or powerful people have to do, is craft a narrative around how Messi, I don't know, is a villain for whatever reason. He doesn't deserve things. FIFA rigged it all for him. He's FIFA's boy. Also, couple that with Argentines are cheaters. Make a narrative around that, you know? And what's the ammunition for them to craft that narrative? They can go all the way back to 1986 with Maradona's Hand of God and use that as a fulcrum to then kind of generalize and extrapolate and say Argentina's a bunch of cheaters. And then along the way, right, sprinkle in some other examples of quote unquote cheating, right? Or quote unquote doing distasteful things. And so it's pretty easy to craft a narrative to smear somebody or something or a whole entire nation. And since people already are looking for reasons to have the great be chopped down from being great, they cling on to these narratives. And then it spreads, Benny.
That's really sad, man. It's like the same people that are talking shit in Argentina about it's rigged and conspiracies, those are the same people that were celebrating Balogun's red card getting overturned, or the same people that were celebrating the VAR for Portugal and Ronaldo. But when it's Argentina now, all of a sudden, oh, fuck those guys. Those guys are villains. It's really sad, man.
It shows also how incredibly susceptible humans are to brainwashing, indoctrination, and being manipulated. And so much so that they don't want to look at themselves. Right now, folks in the audience, or those who are not in the audience, but if they were to come across this, they would never consider that as a truth about themselves. And instead, they would look at me and be like, you are rationalizing, Gary. You are coping, Gary. You are the one who's biased, Gary. And they'll have the reasons for clinging on to that.
Do any of your biases bleed into your analysis, Gary?
I don't think so. And I think a lot of the evidence for that is, well, first off, I'll say, I'm sure I have my biases. And I'm sure something leaks in all walks of life. Okay. But not to this sort of degree. And part of the evidence is what we finished talking about, that I'm highly critical of myself and of the circles that I run in and of the culture that I'm from. We're all very critical of ourselves, self-deprecating. Why? Because we want to get better. And the way that we get better is to try to look at reality and not look at the glasses half full all the time, and not believe that you've already made it, and not already believe that you are the greatest ever. That's the dumbest way to keep improving. The best way to keep improving is, hey, what are you bad at? And all our talks, Benny, all our talks are surrounding that. What are we not good at? What is terrible about us? And I've admitted it from the very beginning. I said before the England game, we suck. We're not as good as England. And what was my prediction there? My prediction was we would be losing 1-0, and then somehow we would tie it, and then we'd hold on to dear life and maybe win in penalties. That was my prediction for the England game. Well, it kind of materialized, and Argentina kind of like, wow, it's pretty incredible, miraculous that you got the second goal and you happen to have won it in regulation time.
Why do you think we didn't see the same version of Argentina that you've seen in previous games where they go down a goal and then all of a sudden it's like a fire is lit underneath them? And you saw it in every single knockout game. I mean, they crawled their way back into the game, and it seemed like against Spain, not that they weren't trying, but they couldn't do it. Why do you think it has to do with the fact that Spain was just bossing possession and it was impossible for Argentina to even get on the ball and try and counter and go score goals? Why do you think we didn't see the same Argentina?
Yeah, I think Spain is just that good at bossing possession. It's just overwhelming. And when Spain would lose the ball, you saw that Argentina struggled to connect the first two or three passes to get out of the pressure and then establish themselves and settle in into a position rhythm themselves. It was hard for them to get out, man. It was really hard for them to get out. Let us not forget all the injuries that happened to Argentina during that match. Lisandro Martinez had to come out before the first half ended. Guti Romero had to come out. So you lost both your starting center backs in that match early in the game. That's devastating, Benny. Now you have to supplant them with two defensive players. So instead of supplanting them with, injecting substitutes that can hold possession higher up the field, no, you burned two substitutions with defenders. So that impacts your capability of holding onto the ball. And the two guys that came in aren't as good, right, as the guys who came out. So it's difficult, dude. And then Scaloni, replaced, and this is the most controversial switch, taking out Molina and putting in Montiel, the outside back. So you've burned three now substitutes on the back line. That's tough, dude. And then you conditioned some players with yellow cards too. So defensively, it was harder to regain the ball because some players were on yellow cards that, in my opinion, weren't necessarily yellow cards. The yellow card on Enzo Fernandez, the first one, so early in the game, is ridiculous. It's a World Cup final. Enzo Fernandez believes he goes down, believes he was fouled, he doesn't get the call, and he does this gesture, to the referee. You don't give a player in a World Cup final early in the game a yellow card because he's disappointed that you didn't call a foul, and from the ground he does this gesture. That's insane, Ben. And speaking about conspiracies and Argentine favorites and all that stuff, if the reverse would have happened and the referee would have given Rodri a yellow card early in the final for complaining that he didn't get a call that went his way, people would cry bloody murder that a Spanish midfielder got a yellow card for just that meager gesture. So that conditions you. And then obviously he gets a red card for what I believe also was not even a foul, or if it's like not worthy of a yellow card, what happened to Enzo. So Enzo should never have gotten out off the field. Now you're with 10 men. Good luck.
And Enzo's not the only player that fucking went. Like every game in the tournament, a player gets fouled and they all do that. Why in that game, in the final, early in the game, is he getting a yellow card?
Totally.
That's crazy, man. All right, Gary, let's show some love to the audience here. I'm going to start bringing up their questions. Oh, before we do that, sorry, audience. I need to bring this up as well. After the game, Gary, okay, there's a little scuffle or altercation. Players get heated. What is your take on that? Because everybody's saying, look at how classless Argentina is. And somebody in the comments right now put Argentina are scumbags. How can you not see that in the game? Like, even, I think it was Pedri or Gavi after the game or the next day to say, listen, I don't think the Argentine players should be held responsible. Like, there should be no repercussions. It's part of the game. This is football. I understand why they did it. So I want to get your whole take on that situation, Gary.
First off, people are brainwashed. Oh, you're thugs, or you're scumbags, or have no class. You are brainwashed. Absolutely brainwashed. First off, this is competitive sport. You are simulating war. That is what sport actually is. That's why we're so enthralled with it. You are simulating warfare. And so you have incredible emotions coursing through your veins throughout this competition. And then you do not know what is going on in the field. You do not know what has transpired throughout the course of a match. You do not know whether somebody said X, Y, or Z to you. You do not know whether there's been small little instigations here or there throughout the match. You do not know after the match what also has happened, because I can point to Jude Bellingham smacking Barco's head after he lost to Argentina, and nobody's saying Jude Bellingham's classless, Jude Bellingham's a thug, all of English people are thugs, and nobody says a word. Imagine if that was an Argentine who came up to a Spaniard and just smacked him in the back of the head. Worldwide news, disaster. There's countless examples of this, countless, but nobody focuses on all the other examples. They focus on these examples. Why? Because Argentina was and has been at the top of the mountain forever. So all eyeballs are on them. And so since all eyeballs are on you, there's a much higher probability of these sorts of things come cropping to the surface, first and foremost. And then second, catching wildfire and going viral and everybody kind of latching onto it. And again, isolated incidents. If you want to call one particular player or two particular players out and saying, oh, look at that person or this person, they shouldn't have done that, fine. But that's not what's happening. They're using those isolated incidents to extrapolate to the entire country of 40 odd million people.
Yeah, another example, and I wish I would have got the receipt, but somebody in the American soccer media posted a video of after the game, and it's of the Argentine players, and in the background, you see Spain doing their celebrations, right? And the analysis is like, look at how classless Argentina is with their back towards the celebration. Like, you can't even... you're not even respectable enough to watch them celebrate. But literally, like, the clip is taken out of context, because if you watch it from another angle, all of the Argentine fans are right there singing to the players. So, of course, the team's going to have a moment with their fans. And so now they're being criticized because they weren't facing the right way during this. Like, get the fuck out of here, guys. Get out of here. Like, what are we doing?
You can do this and craft narratives around an infinite number of circumstances. Grab a circumstance, contort the context, shift the context, change the context however you want or need it to be shifted to fit a particular narrative. You can do it with absolutely every human being on the planet. You can do it absolutely every group of human beings on the planet. You can do it with any circumstance or event on the planet. And that is what happens in things outside of mathematics and physics and the hard sciences, which is why everybody can participate in this sort of stuff, because you can do this. Not to mention, right, that they're saying things like, and I haven't verified this myself, I'm just reading headlines here or there, so you guys have to do your own homework if you can find the truth out there, because it's so manipulated, that when Argentina won the World Cup, you know, France just got their medals and bailed. They weren't even there anymore, you know. But when Argentina lost the World Cup to Germany in 2014, they stuck around, just like they stuck around this time when when Spain beat them. You see? So you're not seeing the complete picture. You're only being fed things out of context to support a particular narrative. And then you, since you are not an expert in this field, and you apparently, many people don't have the intellectual horsepower to understand that this is what's being done to them, they just latch onto it. You know how many people, my girlfriend doesn't watch soccer, never cared about soccer. Now she's like into soccer, right? The whole Haaland craze, you know, Erling Haaland, blah, blah, blah. And she gets caught into this stuff too. She just reads the headlines. She's not an expert in any way, shape, or form. And now she has a vision of what Haaland is like, or Bellingham is like, or Argentina is like. And but it's all based off of superficial narratives that have been going viral.
But they're brainwashed, man. This is what they do to you, Gary. Gary, you're bald, you're Argentinian, you're a white supremacist.
Totally.
I wish you guys could see our DMs of fucking Gary getting called a Nazi fucking 20 times over the past 3 months. That's what they do to you, man.
Yeah, man. It's unfortunate. And, you know, it's a clear sign, Ben, of people who have never acquired a decent level of expertise in anything. Because I'm going to keep repeating this. When you acquire a decent level of expertise in anything at all, maybe it's growing tomatoes. Okay. You're a freaking expert at growing tomatoes. When you have reached a certain level of expertise in at least something, then when you read articles or listen to podcasts or see tweets or Instagram posts on that thing that you are like way up here on, you finally get to see what a bunch of nonsense 99.9% of the stuff that's out there is. You finally get to recognize it because you have a level of discernment that's way up here. But when you don't have any expertise in anything, you never get to see the nonsense that gets spread in every discipline.
All right, now to the audience, Gary, here we go. The 33 specialist wants to know, how do you feel U.S. youth soccer will be influenced by Spain winning the World Cup within the next 4 years?
It won't be influenced at all because what drives everything are incentives, okay? So what are the incentives of youth clubs? What are the incentives of youth coaches? What are the incentives of youth parents? Those are the three like power centers, right? And the youth leagues. What are the incentives of those power centers? Well, the incentives have nothing to do with who won the World Cup. It has nothing to do with it. So they're just going to keep following the incentives that exist in the structure that is the system. And the incentives, in short, are since youth clubs don't have first teams because there's no promotion relegation at the adult/professional level, youth clubs are stuck being youth clubs forever. So the only way of survival and having a viable business without having a first team is by making revenue off of parents. So now you have to charge for your soccer services for youth players. And so what is your incentive? Your incentive is to maximize that. And then your incentive is to make the parents happy one way or another. And that's the system that we live in. The fact that Spain won means nothing. Even if a parent says, oh, well, I want my kid to be playing like Spain or my kid's youth team to be playing like Spain. Well, the incentive of a coach or a club isn't to follow that path because they know they can't do that. And if they try to do that, they don't have the competence for it. You're probably going to lose a lot of games. And if you lose a lot of games, the parents are going to be like, well, this sucks. You know, you guys obviously don't know what you're doing. I'm going to take my kid elsewhere. And so now you've lost the revenue from the parent. So the incentive is for the club and the coach to keep doing what they've been doing, which is in this instance, saying stuff like, well, that's Spain. It's completely different over there. You can't do that here. And they have all kinds of reasons why you can't do that here, even though it's bullshit.
Yeah, we don't have the players to play like Spain, Gary.
Yeah, we don't have the players. It's just different.
All right, here's a really good question, Gary, from our boy Cyber. When we talk about possession football, does aerial control / first touch, headers, and chest receiving get overlooked? Where should that fit into training / age? Spain was really dominant here as well.
That's a good question, good observation. I think in Spanish football, and look, I've been there many times. I've witnessed the training many times. I've witnessed those teams many times in person. Okay. It's not some theoretical thing. I'm not reading articles, right? It is less focused on the aerial game over there for all the reasons that we don't have to get into now. Does it hurt them? Let me see. When we talk about possession, aerial first touch, headers and chest receiving get overlooked. It doesn't get overlooked. It's just not as vital, not as important. Where should that fit into training and age? I mean, here in the U.S., I don't know if it's global. They have rules now, right? You can't head the ball until you're, what is it, Benny? U12 or I don't even know anymore. So obviously you can't do anything before then. And then after then, yeah, train the kids how to head properly. Number one, train the kids how to go one-on-one, you know, with your opponent and gain position over your opponent. Right. Obviously to do that, you have to have a lot of reps and experience, like judging where the ball is going to land. So then you win the position over your opponent at that location, and you have to train it. But I don't think it's as vital as learning technique with your foot and learning brain tactical technique with the ball on the ground.
I think a lot of it too is context dependent. Like most of the stuff I don't think you should be doing in the team training environment, right? Because for example, you don't need your center back to know. I mean, I guess you do. Like I'm thinking of the different types of headers, right? A nine needs to be able to do different types of headers than a center back. Or a winger needs to be able to control the ball with his chest if he's getting sprayed a 40-yard diagonal ball, versus you don't need your eights and tens receiving a ball like that. So I think a lot of that stuff has to come from on your own outside the team training environment. That's where it gets, you know, locked in and executed for sure.
I also think that's a really good that you added that. I also think that learning that skill doesn't take as much in time, energy, or effort as learning the skill with the ball on the ground, the skills with the ball on the ground. You know what I mean? So even if you wanted to train it, it has to be a micro amount of time compared to all the ground-based possession stuff.
Yeah. All right. Here's a comment from Instagram questions. Does the U.S. monopoly have anything to do with the outcome of the World Cup? And I think he's referring to the U.S.'s performance at the World Cup. Does the monopoly have anything to do with the outcome of the World Cup?
If you're talking specifically about the U.S. men's national team, then yes, it has basically everything to do with how good the U.S. men's national team is. Because if you have a monopoly, that means that you don't have competition, which means you don't have a meritocracy. You don't have a competition of ideas. You don't have a competition between players and coaches and scouts and recruiters and clubs. There's no real competition like there is in the rest of the world for the cream to actually rise to the top. And so what you end up getting is a less than, you don't have sporting excellence, basically. So everything is mediocre. So you end up having a mediocre American player pool, which is why we're constantly going crazy about dual nationals, right? And constantly trying to find who else in the world has American blood or, you know, or American father or something like that, that we can convert to the U.S. men's national team, have them play for us, even though they got raised in Germany or in Holland or in wherever, because those players are outside of the monopoly. And those players then had to actually earn their way and maximize their potential.
Here's a question about the 7v7 course, Gary. In a 4v1 rondo, when, if ever, do you allow the ball carrier to pass across the rondo to the player opposite, instead passing to either side of you to support the players?
Yeah, basically never.
And why?
Because what you are training in the 4v1 are very specific things. Yeah. Receiving across the body, having the guys on the ladder, on the adjacent sides, you know, form passing angles, and then you making that decision to go left or right based on the defender's position. And so if you have the ball on one of the sides of the square, the defender is clearly going to be in front of you. Okay. So if he's shifted to the left, then you're going to go to the right. If he shifted to the right, then you're going to go to the left. Going straight down the middle, there's a higher probability of the ball being intercepted, right, or being touched or something by the defender. So that, generally speaking, is not the correct decision. Now, if you want to simulate breaking lines, right, or simulate, you know, verticality and going forward, there are other rondos for that. And if you wanted to incorporate that in the 4v1, hey, you do what you want. But I'm telling you, if you wanted to do that, don't do it too early. Make sure that the players and you as the coach are not doing that for an extremely long period of time, a year, 2 years, 3 years even, so that you master the actual techniques that you're trying to work on. And then you can add that little option if you like. But if you add that little option in the very beginning, then you're confusing the players. Then you're not actually working on what the 4v1 is intended to work on. Same thing with like, oh, hey, well, Gary, why can't you do one touch in a 4v1? Why does it have to be two touches? Well, for the same reasons, because what you want to work on are receiving across the body and then making the decision, receiving, making the decision, and executing the subsequent pass. If you're doing one touch, you're bypassing all of that, and you're bypassing other lessons also. So can you do one touch for 4v1? Yes, but later, work on the fundamentals that the 4v1 is meant to be worked on.
Well, we brought this up many times, and don't make the same mistake that I did, because obviously working with you, Gary, I've had access to every single layer of the course or every single phase. And so naturally you get excited and it's like, oh, wow, I want to try this, you know, 4v4 plus 3 round. And you can't make the mistake of moving on before the players are ready to move on. Now, how do you determine if they're ready? Yeah, and you yourself. But how do you determine you're ready? They are ready. It's very difficult. But I think you'll be able to tell if you move on and they're just not understanding the next concept of it. I mean, you really have to, and it doesn't happen in a month or 2 months, Gary. It takes years. It's not a 1 year thing. It's every day, man. Every day for years, you need to be doing this. All right, here we go. Jaime Garcia, I want to say I just found your content. Preach, music to my ears. Jaime, you got a lot of catching up to do, man. There's thousands and thousands of hours of content available. All right, here we go. Next one. Did you hear Eric Wynalda's blueprint to fixing youth soccer players? He highlighted the lack of separating the wheat from the chaff, making cuts, and telling players they aren't good enough.
I did come across that actually earlier this morning when I was just perusing online because I didn't want to do any work. I did. And Eric, I like Eric. I support Eric. I think he says a lot of good things that need to be said with the platform that he has, with the credentials that he has. That said, he always fails. Always is a strong word, but generally he fails to get to the root of the problem. So go back to that question.
Here's Cyrus follow-up. He did not mention promotion.
Yeah. So like everybody, they fail to go one step deeper and identify why things are the way they are here and why they are the way they are elsewhere in the world. So separating the wheat from the chaff, right? And saying, you're not good enough, get out, go do something else, right? That only happens if there's an incentive for that to happen. There is no incentive for that to happen in the United States. The incentive is keep everybody because they're paying customers. And if you want to talk about the MLS franchise, quote unquote, academies that are free to play, they're not paying customers. There's also not much of an incentive like there is elsewhere in the world. There isn't as much of an incentive of going out and scouting and scouting and scouting and scouting and scouting and finding and then replacing and kicking players off of the academy teams because you're not fighting for survival. You don't have to develop players for the first team because the first team doesn't need or is not in any sort of desperate need for players from the youth academy. They don't care.
This is almost like promotion and relegation is a dirty phrase. Taylor Twellman had a similar interview where he only hinted at what the rest of the world does. You think this is like a forbidden phrase that, you know, as an operator in the ecosystem, if you want to work with MLS, you do not say the words promotion and relegation. Like, those words should not come out of your mouth.
Well, they shouldn't come out of your mouth in a certain way. Like, it can come out of your mouth if you want to trash it or smear it or right. Make fun of it. Like, then you can say it. Yeah. And there's two groups. There's, because Taylor Twellman is different than Eric Wynalda. Taylor Twellman is a company man who's benefiting from the monopoly and works basically for the monopoly, directly or indirectly, it doesn't matter, works for the monopoly. And so, yeah, it makes sense that that guy's not going to say jack shit. But Eric Wynalda, the reason he's not saying jack shit is a different reason.
All right. So there was a earlier comment about intensity in the team training environment. I think this is the same guy I brought up, or I screenshotted one of his questions that he emailed to you, Gary. So if you're the same guy in the chat, let us know. I have recently taken over a U11 boys team that went 1-23 last year. They have a lot of potential, but have never been properly taught to play the game. The training intensity just isn't there yet. Any advice on how to handle this? I don't want to be a drill sergeant, but I will if needed.
Can you take this one, Benny? Do you have ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've been in this guy's shoes. I don't know if he himself was the coach last year when they were 1-23, or if he's now taking over a team. But I will say this, man, things have to change. Okay. And you are going to have to be a drill sergeant, but there's a way to do that without the players turning on you. And the way to do that is by showing them love off the field, building a relationship with them so that they know that when you're yelling at them in training, when you're criticizing them in training, they know it's coming from a place of love, right? Because if things stay the same and you try to be the relaxed coach and the chill coach, I mean, nothing's going to change, man. I think you're the one who said this, Gary, where I heard it first, that when you're coaching, it can't be a democracy, right? It can't be everybody has their opinions and, oh, we should play like this. No, it's a dictatorship, man. What you say as a coach goes, and if people don't fall in line, then they're out. And you have to set that standard from day one. But the other thing to consider is, listen, again, it's context dependent, because I don't know what level these kids are playing at, but perhaps just going off the record, if they're 1-23, they might be playing in the wrong division. You know, maybe the coach is telling the parents, like, yeah, guys, we want to play flight two. That's where we are. But maybe in reality, you're not a flight two team. Maybe you're a flight three team. You know, so you have to give an honest assessment with yourself as a coach to say, this is the best fit for where these guys are going to play.
I can't say it better than you, Benny. I think the first point is the most important one. Love off the field. And then in this guy's comment, drill sergeant on the field.
Yeah, you have to be a drill sergeant, man. And if you guys have been listening for a long time, you know that I was a player of Brian as well. Brian's trainings are fucking intense, man. Like, he will get on you if you're not doing what it is that he wants the team to complete. And if you're not doing that, he's going to let you know. But you never feel that Brian's a dick or Brian is putting me down, or he doesn't. You never feel that, because off the field, he builds that relationship with you where that, you know, he wants what's best for you. So anytime that he's a drill sergeant, but it's like, all right, I'm going to listen to, no matter what this guy says, I'm going to do it, you know? And I think that's the relation. And again, that's easier said than done. A lot of coaches maybe don't have the capability, or maybe they're just not like personable and know how to build relationships and have a good rapport with their players. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's definitely something that you can improve on your craft.
It's a skill.
Yeah.
It's a skill for sure.
All right, here we go. Will the USL Pro Rel system coming within the next year have a real ability to threaten the monopoly?
A couple reframings here. Number one, we don't know whether it's coming next year, yes or no. A lot of people talk, and until something actually happens, it's all talk. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, it's all talk. Second reframing is that this isn't true promotion relegation. True promotion relegation is an instantiation of an open free market ecosystem. And USL can't do that. They can't do that. That's why federations exist. Federations exist to create the regulatory environment of the entire country. They are the ones who basically decree, you know, by fiat and through the regulations, hey, this is the law of the land. There's going to be division one, two, three, whatever it happens to be. The clubs are individually owned, separate entities all unto themselves. And through sporting merit, you're going to go up and down the ladder. And no central entity, like a league, quote unquote, a league, no central company is going to own, right, all the teams like MLS effectively does. So even though you're doing a sort of ladder up and down, it's all within the bubble that is USL. So it's not a true free market ecosystem. I'll give you another example. I live by, the closest club I have here is Orange County SC. They play at the Great Park in Irvine, okay? Handful of miles away from me. If I wanted to start my own club in this region, I can't, because Orange Soccer Club is territorially protected by USL. No other USL team club can exist within a particular perimeter around this one that I've got next door. That is not an open free market. I should be able to start my own club wherever I want. That's a free market. And enter my way up and down wherever I want. That's a free market.
You're saying your own pro club, right?
Yeah, my own pro club. I start wherever. Well, I can't do that. So it's not a free market. So it's not true promotion relegation. It's not an open ecosystem. So will it threaten the MLS monopoly? Probably not. Probably not. And because, I mean, there's a threat, but if what you mean by threat means taking over, right, MLS, or just making MLS completely fail, probably not, because it's not a legit thing. It's a gimmick. It's a simulation of true promotion relegation. And the danger here is that if they were to implement this, and since it's not real, it won't attract the massive investments that an open ecosystem would attract. And since it won't attract an explosion in popularity of USL, what's going to happen is MLS and its media muppets are going to create all these narratives saying, see, pro-rel doesn't work. If pro-rel worked, USL would take over the entire country and be huge, right? Like the Premier League or like La Liga or like all you pro-rel people have been talking about. See, it didn't work. It's not true. Shut the fuck up. MLS is the way. The only exception to this, Benny, the only exception is if the Federation were to jump in and, number one, give USL also Division One status. So the USL Championship right now, which is Division Two, because divisions are a weird thing to say when there's no promotion relegation, right? But USL Championship, give it Division One status, or USL Premier, I think is what they're going to call it. So USL has Division One, has Division Two, has Division Three. And if the Federation jumped in and had USL kind of get rid of all these restrictions, then maybe you've kind of formed a free market that can build around USL. And then, yes, MLS is in big trouble.
But they won't, right? Because US soccer is basically infiltrated by MLS plant.
Correct.
So, crazy. All right. Mr. Trent Boring says, I didn't realize how parasitic MLS is. Their content creators are posting anti-relegation videos with 40,000 views. Here was the top comment. I'm sick of the pro-rel argument in the US. Trent, send me that video on 343's Instagram because I want to see it. What do you think, Gary?
Well, yeah, I mean, that MLS is a monopoly, so it controls everything. And so it controls the media. The media will only gain access and be relevant if they conform to the monopoly. So, of course, you're going to see all these narratives is my point.
This is just further expansion. I'm sick of the pro-rel conversation coming from people who don't even watch MLS. My hot take is that the league generally doesn't need it. That was the main comment and the most agreed. Parasites, truly.
Well, it's not true, though, because the vast majority, in my estimation, of people talking about pro-rel and wanting pro-rel are people who do know quite a bit about MLS and have watched quite a bit about MLS. I'll speak for myself. I've been watching and attending MLS since 1996, since it was started. I have watched more MLS than the vast majority, if not all, of the people who actually cover the MLS. That's how much I know about it and have watched it. So I think this take is just another narrative to smear the people clamoring for an open ecosystem.
Here's another one for you. Can you give your opinion on why the Italian men's national team has fallen off despite competing in a pro-rel ecosystem in Europe with culture and players in a top five league? Great question.
Yeah, it is a good question. I'm going to give you the first one that came to my mind, okay? I'd have to think about it further to give you a really more detailed response. The first one that came to mind is, what is Italian football historically most known for? It's historically most known for defense, okay? And this is going to be a good little tie-in with the Argentine smear campaign that's currently ongoing. The Italians, think about Gattuso, Maldini, that whole cohort of players when they were great, they were masters of the dark arts. They were dirty motherfuckers, okay? Especially defensively speaking, Nesta, all those guys. Strikers feared them. You can go back and watch interviews of Van Nistelrooy or whatever. Who would you not want to confront, you know, on the weekends? Or it was always the Italians and the Italian clubs. And so over the course of time, in the past 10 years especially, everything around the game has gotten softer and softer and softer and softer. And it's gotten to the point where you can't touch anybody anymore. You touch somebody, it's a foul for sure. And it might even be a yellow card. So you basically destroyed Italian football by having the game become incredibly soft and for pussies. You've destroyed the virtues of Italian football. And so they don't know what to be anymore. So that was my initial reaction to this question, because I've thought about it quite a bit myself. And I've read and listened to a lot of Italian legends as well over the course of the years. I think that is the main factor, Ben. So what do? They're not masters of possession. They're not masters of the counterattack. They're not masters. They were masters of defense, and they took defense away from them.
Well, I'm glad that question got brought up, because that's what a lot of folks will use as an argument as to why we don't need promotion relegation here in the U.S. is, well, Gary, you're saying promotion relegation is a magical solution. Look at all the other countries around the world that have promotion relegation, and we're still better than them, or we still compete at a higher level than them.
Well, we're not. Well, first off, we're not. Okay. I bet you we lose to Italy if we played Italy. Italy just hasn't been able to qualify to World Cups. We qualify to World Cups because we play against fucking the Cayman Islands. You know what I'm saying? We play against nobodies. CONCACAF is so easy to be around and qualify from. But just because you have an open ecosystem doesn't mean that you're going to be the best in the world, and doesn't guarantee that you're going to be among the world's elites. All it guarantees is that you're going to maximize your potential, because you have an open competition of ideas, and the true cream will rise to the top. The true cream in ideas, the true cream in players, the true cream in coaches, the true cream in business people, the true cream in absolutely everything. And so you have a chance of maximizing your potential with an open ecosystem. Now, since the rest of the world, except for our dumb fuck idiots over here in the United States and Canada, and now Mexico recently too, since we don't do it, we're only like three nations, Australia, okay, four nations. Just because a handful of nations don't have promotion relegation doesn't mean that the ones who do are going to be above everybody else. If you want to talk about the United States and Mexico, look how big our countries are. Look how big our populations are. Look how big our soccer playing populations are. So just the law of large numbers says that you're going to, out of this dumpster fire of closed ecosystem, you're still going to get some jewels that come out of it, because the numbers are so huge. You're still going to have a Christian Pulisic that'll pop out of nowhere. Of course, Christian had to leave to make sure that he doesn't get destroyed by the monopoly. You're going to get some good players. Mexico's going to get some good players. Canada's going to get some good players. And are they going to be better than Trinidad and Tobago? Trinidad and Tobago has pro rel. Why is Trinidad and Tobago not better than U.S. and Mexico? Because Trinidad and Tobago is this big, and it goes beyond population size and soccer playing population size. It goes into infrastructure and money and wealth. Generally speaking, we are such an enormously wealthy country in the United States that that fact alone also enables us to at least muster up some decent players.
Why do you think Canada hasn't cut ties with MLS yet, Gary? Like, why aren't they just going and making their own league in Canada and having their own open ecosystem? Like, why are they still tied to MLS? I don't get it.
I'm not an expert in Canada. I don't have an answer to that. My mind goes to, it just seems like they're weak and soft and followers and not leaders, generally speaking.
Our new friend Jaime Garcia that I brought up, he says he's from Canada, so maybe he can share some input with us. All right, here we go. Average Joe says, Gary, what's your take on Herc Gomez saying that the U.S. is officially a soccer country now after the World Cup TV numbers?
Should it be vulgar?
Do it, bro. Do it. That's why people come to the 343 podcast, to hear Gary be vulgar.
This guy's an imbecile. Hercules Gomez, a complete imbecile. And completely compromised, has no skills whatsoever. He's a talking head. Fine. He's a former player. That's what gives him, or gave him, the opportunity to be graced with a platform from ESPN or for whoever he works for. He was given a platform. He didn't build his own platform. He's a former pro. Broadcasters are like, oh, you're a former pro? Fine. Let's throw you in front of the TV. That's fine. And that's how he has his platform. He talks without knowing anything. He's never built anything himself. I've been saying that we're a soccer country for decades, and it didn't happen now. We've always been a soccer country, but it's never been allowed to flourish. In 1994, the 1994 World Cup was the most attended World Cup and watched World Cup in the history of the sport. Up until this one, right? We were a soccer country back then. this guy saying we're officially a soccer country is the stupidest comment in the world. I have nothing more to say. This guy's an imbecile. I don't know what's Benny. It's just stupid.
Are you open to a discussion with Hercules Gomez, Gary?
I don't think so. No.
I'd say Herc invites you, calls you up, Gary. I want you to come on my show.
No. I'll tell you why. He's one of those types of people who doesn't want to have a real conversation. He doesn't want to have a real conversation. He wants to have, I don't know, a way of smearing me or smearing others and elevating himself. So all of the framing that he will be centered around that. And if I were to go on his show, then he has final cut of what gets shown to the public and what gets cut out and what gets clipped. So when you give somebody that sort of power, what is that? What's the end result? You don't get to have a real conversation, and all they're going to do is elevate themselves and smear the guest. It's stupid. If he wants to come on the 343 show, I would consider it, but I still feel that it's not. I have people who act in good faith, Benny, and the guy does not act in good faith.
Understood. All right. I'm going to bring up a couple more. This was in a comment to one of our reels as to why you said that they want Pochettino gone. And basically the reason you gave was that he's saying too many hard truths. And one of those hard truths was that American sports breeds losers. Okay, so this guy's comment says, this is so idiotic. You're going to argue that NFL and the NBA and MLB breed losers because they don't have relegation. That's the most important comment from that. But he also says, Poch is a hedge fund hire that needs to go. He's clueless. And the Belgian game proves he ran the program on vibes. So just in that last sentence, we can already write this guy off. But let's respond to his question or statement, I guess. You're going to argue that the NFL, the NBA, and MLB breed losers because they don't have relegation. What are your thoughts, Gary?
Yeah, well, see, the fundamental problem when you have a closed system is you have no way of judging where the bar actually is. So what do I mean by that? You have to accept that whoever happens to be in the NBA or in the NFL or in MLB are the best. Period, end of story, because they're there. So a priori, you have to run on that assumption. And it's a bad assumption, because if there is no relegation and there's no promotion, then there's no way, there's no filtering process to understand and maximize a player's potential or coach's potential or anybody's potential. There's no filter. You have to rely exclusively on some gatekeeper telling you that these are the best. I don't know how else to explain that. And secondly, since there's no international competition, you don't have the United States NFL team, you know, American football playing against the other country's American football. So you don't get to be checked, right? And see who is truly supreme and who isn't. Now, this person might be saying, well, we would smash everybody. Well, yeah, because nobody cares about that. Nobody plays that around the world. Nobody plays these sports around the world. I don't even know who the worst NFL teams are nowadays. Let's say like the Cleveland Browns or Detroit Lions. I don't even know. And you're sitting at the bottom of the table. Nobody is dying, right, to try to survive. And if you're not dying trying to survive, then clearly you're not maximizing your effort, mental effort, anything. So you can just chill. You are in chill mode. And guess what? When you are in chill mode, that is a loser mentality of being in chill mode.
This guy says the lack of an open ecosystem is beginning to hurt America and other sports. More and more foreigners are in the NBA, like what you said, Gary. And if Spain, for example, wanted to develop NFL players, they could and they would. All right, Gary, let's bring in a couple more before we go. Gary, do you think, I'm not sure if you even know who these guys are. Do you think Larry Berg, LAFC owner, and David Nathanson, Fox executive, becoming new MLS commissioner would change anything?
Nothing at all. The commissioner is basically just an employee. It's just a bureaucrat. It's just a politician. It's just a face of something. Yeah, they're involved in committees and decision-making and to set the course and direction, but they work for the owners of MLS LLC. I don't know how many owners there are, how many equity holders there are in MLS, how many of those have voting power, what the equity structure is like, but they are the ones who determine what happens, not the commissioner.
So, but is it a meaningless position here? I mean, they must hold some.
No, well, you're an executive. And what's an executive? The name already tells you what an executive is. They execute on operations. They execute on the strategy. They execute on the plan. But who sets those things are the owners. The commissioner can't come in and be like, we are going to work with US Soccer to open the ecosystem and have all the franchises of MLS be independent entities. In other words, real clubs. The commissioner cannot do that. It's impossible. He doesn't have the power to do that. What does he have the power to do? Make up meaningless, almost inconsequential things surrounding the game. That's all. Oh, you want to raise the salary cap? Well, he can say he wants to raise the salary cap, but he can't decree that we're raising the salary cap. He has to go to the quote-unquote board of governors, which guess who comprised the board? The owners of MLS. He has to go to the owners of MLS and say, hey, I think we should raise the salary cap to this. And then the owners are ultimately going to do their own analysis. How's this going to affect my equity stake? How's this going to affect the overall blah, 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 blah. Do mathematical analysis, do all kinds of stuff. And the owners will come back to the commissioner and say, okay, cool, proceed. Or nope, we're not doing that. Done.
We need you in there, man. Not as a commissioner, but just as.
No, it doesn't matter. It's over. You can't. The only way to crack this nut, as I said, is massive education by the public. And that leads to massive rejection of the monopoly, which is now an incentive, an external stimuli to the monopoly to radically change the way, or be open to radically change the way that they do things. And this also gives the regulator, US Soccer, USSF, and the people who run that show, the political power or the confidence, right, to steer things dramatically in a different direction.
Somebody says MLS is run by the Jewish mafia.
Very strange. I don't know.
The state of quarterback development is actually awful. None of these quarterbacks can read defenses. You know, what's interesting, Gary, is that whenever you think about NFL, right? We all assume NFL quarterbacks, best players in the world, right? But no other country in the world cares about football. So the standard that we're seeing is what we consider to be the best, but we don't actually know if it is actually quality, because imagine if every other country in the world cared about American football and developed all their resources into it. Maybe we would be absolutely shocking in football as well, Gary. You would, but you won't know. You don't
know. No, and even if you forgot international competition, that's the ultimate check on how good you are, right, at something. But even if you got rid of that, you just look locally and you run the thought experiment, which shouldn't be much of a thought experiment, because if you know anything about open ecosystem, open markets, generally speaking, you know what I'm talking about. If you just open it up, let's say the NBA, open up ProRel, you don't get things like maybe LeBron James' kid being offered a pro contract and being on the Lakers. Is that even true? I think that's true, right? You don't get that sort of stuff if somebody's not good enough. You don't get the Lakers being like last place and Kobe Bryant doing his, you know, final tour around the league with the Lakers, you know, because that hurts the Lakers and you might be threatened of relegation. That shit doesn't happen anymore. You're not good enough. It's over. Your legacy's done. Just like Barcelona or PSG or the top European clubs wouldn't want Messi on their team. It's over. He's over the hill. He can't compete at that level day in and day out, week in and week out in the Champions League with a top team in the world that wants to win the Champions League. No, you're phenomenal, Messi, but no. Or Cristiano Ronaldo. No. Yeah. It'd be cool if PSG or whatever had Cristiano Ronaldo on the team, because he's Cristiano Ronaldo. He has so many followers. People will be paying attention and, you know, we can sell more jerseys or God knows what else. No fucking chance. You're out. So you weed out the dead weight, the old skin cells, right? Have to go to be supplanted with the new skin cells. So bringing it back to the NBA or NFL or whatever, with relegation, dead weight, get the fuck out. And they're constantly looking to how to upgrade. The fear of relegation pushes your level way higher, which will push the mid-level teams to go higher. Otherwise, they're going to go be at the bottom of the table, and now they're threatened of relegation. So since the mid-level teams are pushed higher, the top teams who are contending for championships have to push higher too.
Yeah. If there's promotion relegation, Bronny James does not make the Lakers. Or imagine Kobe's farewell tour is last season. The Lakers are playing, who was the last game? I think it was the Jazz on Kobe's last game. Whoever loses is getting relegated. You're not putting Kobe on the floor. And yes, he's the greatest player of all time, arguably. But towards that stage in his career, he wasn't the most competitive guy. You're battling for your life. But that type of stuff doesn't happen here, man.
Or, because I think he scored a shit ton of points, right, in his last game also. The opponent isn't going to let that happen. So the opponent will be playing at their maximum, right, if there was a threat of consequences. They didn't play at their maximum. They just let Kobe shoot his shots. Oh, you're shooting? Okay, I'll let you shoot. Oh, you're driving, you know, to the hole? Okay, I'll get out of the way.
All right, I'm going to end with two questions here, Gary, so we don't go.
Yeah.
We could go all day here.
Yeah.
President Trump got FIFA to get rid of a red card in the middle of the World Cup. Think he can get Johnny to implement pro rel? White House is getting involved in college sports as well. Worth a shot?
Yeah, that's the other avenue, right, that I mentioned for massive change to happen is the actual government gets involved. Congress, Senate, the executive branch, the judicial branch, they get involved. They're like, no, this is a monopoly. You have to break up a monopoly. We're going to create an open ecosystem in our sports and we're going to legislate it. Yeah, that's another absolute. So could Trump, does the executive have the power to shift this? Yes, they do have the power. And yes, there would be challenges. Yes, there would be lawsuits. Yes, it would go up to the Supreme Court, but that level of intervention could definitely do the job.
Right. Do you think Trump even cares about soccer in this country? No.
Probably not. I mean, it'd be awesome if you know, somebody pissed him off in the sport. He's like, oh yeah, you pissing me off? All right, let's break your shit up.
Trump is savage, man. All right, that's all I'm going to say.
That's why professional sports, people say professional sports is all about entertainment, Gary. No, it's not. It's deeply political, deeply economical, it's deeply, fundamentally, the most important thing is not the entertainment. It's about power, political power, cultural power, economic power, social power. You see, depending on who's in the White House, our pro sports actually shift their narratives and shift the way that they actually operate. You got the socialist sociopaths in there. All of a sudden, you got rainbow flags all over the stadiums. You got this guy in there. All of a sudden, the rainbow flags, they're still kind of there, but now it's not as egregious as it used to be. Why?
All right. Let's end with this, Gary. Let's end on a positive note with some coaching education here.
Sure.
M. Dell says, I have little Neymar on my team. He will dribble/skill move on every play/touch. How do you coach better decision-making in younger players?
So many different answers to this, so many different techniques and ways. One is through a proper coaching methodology, kind of like what we've always been offering. So you teach them how to build out of the back, how to transition in the midfield, how to transition into the attack. And you have exercises for that. And so for this particular little Neymar kid, he's obviously going to be partaking in those exercises. And so through those exercises, you're teaching little Neymar, these are the correct decisions for the team to accomplish these sorts of goals. That's one way. The other way is maybe giving homework, saying, hey, go watch such and such a player and focus on their decision-making in these scenarios. What do they do? Or you yourself or your staff or whoever over the course of time, I know there's a lot of work and coaches are underpaid and it's crazy. You accumulate a bunch of clips, video clips of professional players, let's say Neymar himself, and what decision, when he does quote unquote good decision-making on the field, and show the little kid, look, this is your idol. And look at the proper decisions that your idol is making also. Hey, you keep doing your flashy stuff or whatever, but right place and right time. And in these circumstances, This is what Neymar does. This is what Messi does. Look, they keep it simple. They make the right decision. What can you add, Ben?
We talk about it a lot, watching the game at a high level on TV, but with a specific objective in mind, right? So if you are a winger, right, you are spotlighting the winger every single time he gets the ball. How does he react when he doesn't have the ball, when he's moving off the ball? How does he react defensively, right? But it can't just be you watch one game and you watch the winger for one game. No, it's a lifelong thing that you continue to watch and grow and develop as a player, right? And then it's just, if you have a proper methodology and you're putting a winger in specific scenarios every game, you give them the green light. Like, for example, if you're a left winger and you're 1v1 with their outside back, that is the green light. You're 1v1, go at them. But if you're 1v2 or 1v3, is that the best time for you to go and take on the players? Probably not, right? So it's giving them the solutions to the problems that they're going to encounter on the field. And if the kid's not listening, he's turning over the ball in situations where he could have easily kept it. He's not going to learn if you keep allowing it to happen. The bench is a very powerful thing. Now, I'm not saying bench Neymar because he wants to dribble every time, but you got to draw the line, man. And you got to say, these are your responsibilities. This is what is required of you in these positions, and go execute them.
Yeah, another little added thing. It depends on context too, because I don't know if this is a 7-year-old or a 13-year-old, right? So it's age dependent. Have them look at the winger in a professional game and have them write down what the decision was every touch, and keep it simple for them. Look at every touch. How many times did they dribble? How many times did they do a skill move? And how many times did they play simple? You know, one touch or pass it to their teammate or something like this. And the kid himself will start realizing, or the parent or whatever, realizing, holy crap, Neymar himself, well, Neymar's old now, right? But player like pick whoever you want, Saka, okay? Wow, Saka, 90% of his touches are a simple back pass to his outside back or his central midfielder. And only 10% of the time, he's dribbling through people or doing skill moves.
All right, I'm going to end with this one. I know I said it on the last one, but let's end here. When are you and Eric Guinalda going to get on a podcast together? I would love to hear you guys discuss both on what you agree on and disagree on. I think it would be super informative.
Yeah, I'm open to doing that with Eric. I think he acts in good faith, unlike these other guys. You know, he reached out to me one time via Twitter and was like, hey, Gary, we should like do something together. I'm like, sure, I'm open to anything, but it never went beyond that. And then the guy who runs his, or I presume the guy who runs his like YouTube channel and does his video editing or something, reached out. And he's like, hey, you know, I'm going to organize something. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, just let me know what day, what time. And I never heard back from that guy either. So
you're open to it.
Yeah. There's no problem there.
All right. Awesome. All right, Gary, any closing remarks, anything that we missed?
No, it's always fun to do these. I think what I'd like to do, and the audience could chime in also and give some commentary, but this is for you, 'cause I haven't mentioned it to you, Benny. We should do 2 a week. One is the live like this, and one is just our typical conversation where we're talking about a particular topic. But the live one, what I'd like to do is talk on a weekly basis about the current events of the week and give our perspective of the current events of the week, because people aren't getting this alternative perspective of the current events. They're getting basically the monolithic culture's perspective of weekly events. And that is harming, that's harming people. It's brainwashing people. They need an alternative. So if we have current event now, like Jurgen Klopp just got announced as, or didn't get announced, had his first press conference as the new German manager. You know, we should probably have our take, our view of what he said in that press conference. And I'll give it to you right now as just a little sampler, and then we could sign off from here. So I just read the headline. I didn't watch the press conference. So grain of salt, I just saw that some of the headlines, some of the quotes, where he basically laid out the ground rules already under which conditions he is being the national team manager for Germany. He's like, hey, listen, if you all start being aggressive and going after my family, or, you know, doing what you did to Tuchel, or doing what you did to Nagelsmann, or doing what you, the press and the public and the fan base, everything, then I'm out. I don't want any severance pay. I don't want anything. I will immediately leave. And he basically had a posture of, I'm doing this as a favor to you guys. Like, you're not doing me any favors by hiring me on as the German national team coach. I'm doing you a favor for taking this position And I am setting the conditions under which I will continue being the national team manager. There's a lot of interesting things there to talk about. Because if that were an Argentine manager saying that, what would have been the reaction? What an arrogant piece of shit. Classic Argentine. Classic dictatorial thing. They'd probably even throw racism in there somehow. They'd finagle racism in there somehow. But since it's Jurgen Klopp, who historically has been a likable guy, has a big smile on his face always. He speaks good English, right? He's Anglo, right, in the traditional sense. He gets a pass. They might say, they might make one remark here, there, but it's fine. It's Jurgen Klopp.
Sure, you're not biased at all. You've made every excuse for Argentina. Now put that with how you look at the U.S. So don't give me the BS. You had it right at first. Total human nature.
We've already addressed this, and we've addressed this. We know what this person is.
All right, guys. That was a fun one, Gary.
Yeah, cool.
In the chat, we appreciate you guys. Like, comment, and subscribe. It helps a lot more than you know. Let's keep spreading the word.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.